My title is Pity Porn or Activism for Social Justice, and it's a critical look at museums of migration. And over the last couple of years, I've been quite involved in advisory work with the European Union around migration and museums, and looking at museums that are in formation around migration, including the one in Malmo that's being... I wonder, are you guys in touch with Malmo? No. They're building a museum of migration there. So there's been a lot. It's been, as we know, the big subject. It overlaps with other interests of mine that are around activism. And I thought I'd just look at this pity porn notion. It's usually used in cinema or TV production. And it's this notion of how we represent the whole notion of migration as tragic, but not necessarily going the next step where we're actually actively engaged in terms of looking at how does this relate to change or making any kind of policy difference or any other. It's a term that I deliberately use. The other area that I'm really interested in is social justice, and I'm not the only one. There are many, many museums that have been taken up this notion of museums of social justice mostly over the last 5 years, but some longer. And for me, the things that really influence me are this whole notion of Amartya Sen, who's an economist, a welfare economist, a Nobel Prize winner, no doubt heard of him, but his notion that to be heard is a central element that people can, and it's easily given rhetoric to, but it's actually not always in practice. The other aspect of Sen's work that is central is the notion of capability. So the question is, whose capability is developed through our engagement? And essentially for him, the capability starts with the freedom to make a choice. So this is very, and there's somebody else, Martha Nussbaum, whose work overlaps with Sen, and they both of them really emphasize this notion of capability, and your rights are central here, that your rights as a human being are central, that you have a right to make these choices in terms of your livelihood, and that you have a right to have a focus on your capabilities. Now, as we know, the reality for migrants is rarely a focus on capabilities. So those are the areas I'm interested in. And just to give you some background and what I'm looking at. Now, I'm going to... one of the things I've been very concerned with is the notion of kindness, and I have a problem with it. It's quite a bizarre thing to say, but I also have a problem with empathy and with tolerance. I have a problem with organizations being helpful to others who are perceived to be in need. Now, of course, migrants are most definitely in need, but I guess the question is, are they only in need, or is that the image of the migrant that actually keeps the migrant restricted or restrained within that perception? And I'll talk some more about that. I've been looking at Professor of Rhetorics Feng Chi in Berkeley. I've been looking at the whole notion of humanitarianization of the world, and museums operate within a notion of acting in a humanitarian way. So this is a good thing, and we have to assume that's a good thing. But there are questions, and most of those questions are coming from the Southern Hemisphere, about what humanitarianism actually means in practice, and what its effect is, because there is the notion that humanitarianization of people also serves to turn people into passive subjects or passive suffering victims and objects of pity. So we're back to this notion of kindness. It seems perverse to be arguing against this. What I'm trying to get at is to say, look at the effect of the relationship between us and the and people we're working with, who in this case happen to be migrants, and who globally now are migrants are an enormous issue. So how does this affect us in terms of our relationship? So there's he talks about hi. Feng Shi talks about a conscious ethics of giving. And so I'm going to just refer to this little, I've written about it, this little parable, but there's a very interesting notion. So you can read it yourselves, or I can read it out to you. The monkey sees the fish, he searches it up, he says, you know, look how happy the fish is. And of course the fish dies, and he says, oh, if only I had come sooner, I would have saved him. And it's this notion that we place ourselves in a position in relation to others that we are here to help. So what does that do in terms of our relationship with others? All of my work is concerned with the ethics of our relationship with others. So it is about what are we conscious of those ethics. So so Chi talks about resisting the humanitarianization of the world. So not just being caught up in it without questioning what it does to the to people on the receiving end of that. He says, by giving succor to human beings, regardless of national affiliations, transnational humanitarian action seeks to humanize the globe by making it a place that is more hospitable to humanity at large. But the problem is, as he puts it, the humanitarianization of the world destroys the worlds of aid-receiving peoples because it regards them as passive suffering victims and objects of pity, and erodes their dignity and self-determination. And when I'm talking about migrants, dignity and self-determination are central elements. So in other words, with the best of intentions, our kindness can actually undermine the empowerment of those whom we are attempting to empower, for want of a better word, effectively preventing their self-empowerment. So, okay, so I'll just go back here a bit for a minute. I want to talk a little bit about my own experience. I have to exclude the sunglasses. I've lost my glasses, sorry. These are photographs from my own work with refugee women in Manchester. It must be more than a decade ago. It's probably 15 years ago. And we broke some new ground. There weren't, when we started this work, and it was a program called Telling Our Lives originally, and then it became called The Contact Zone. It's based on Clifford's notion of the contact zone. So the notion was the women were referred to us by health authorities. They were for mental health reasons. They were depressed. They were isolated. They were 15 stories up in a high rise in Manchester. Many of them were Somali. A number of them were Sudanese, and then later Afghani. So we thought, great, we're going to offer opportunities for them to talk through objects and then talk about their own objects. And we reveal, we felt that this was a chance for them to open up. However, and we won awards for this work, by the way. We won awards in Europe, we won awards locally. We built an actual contact zone with a film studio where we asked their permission to record these. They were put on YouTube. And then it became clearer and clearer that the museum was containing the exchange. So the museum was not, what we weren't taking into account was the disparity in the relationship between the museum as an institution and these women, of course. I mean, call that fantastic naivety, but that the women, what became very clear to me was when I would evaluate this work, I'd find that the women outside of the museum or outside of the formality of the sessions had an entirely different relationship with us, and were and in many cases were fairly critical, and but found themselves constrained within the situation of the museum. And what became clear to me was how the subtle ways that the museum contains these relationships and puts limitations on the relationships in terms of how we work. And that that developed further, and I'll talk about it a little some more. The another instance I wanted, and this is Robin Bose talking about that, that the intellectual control is always still in the hands of the museum. A lot of it is the way that the whole exchange is set up. The museum invites people into their space. The whole agenda is set by the institution in the subtlest of ways. Sometimes it's set up where those who come in are in a position where they are thanking as though they're the guests of the institution. So it puts them in a very restrained or difficult relationship to be able to open up in any kind of free and open dialogue. The subtleties of how these relationships work have been of great interest to me. Some years back, I was asked to go and to visit a Northern European museum that was very progressive, very well known. It was new, and it had invited in migrants to help advise on the setting up of a big exhibition, a major gallery. And they invited the migrants in and gave them a position within the institution and said, we are colleagues and co-collaborators. And they had a space like this, their own space, and they met on a regular basis planning the exhibition. So far, so good. It looks like a real co-production. However, the relationship had completely broken down. So they asked me to come and try and figure out what had gone wrong. They couldn't figure it out. And they, when I got there, I met with a group of migrants and up by themselves and had a really lengthy conversation with them. And it turned out the relationship had gone sour based on the simplest of things. They had called them colleagues, but they had a separate coffee space for museum staff and the migrant group. So they never met as people. They never met as, they didn't speak outside of the co-production. And of course, that's one side of it. So they weren't colleagues in that sense. But the other side of it was, of course, the museum's agenda moves on in the times over coffee. So the discussions that were formalized when they'd meet had already moved on because they were having those conversations in a more casual sense. So these are the things that when we think about we're trying to set up these equitable relationships, well, they're not equitable, and we have to be far more conscious of the inequalities in these relationships. One of the most important things is to ask people, how is this relationship for you? So these are, these are again slides from the... So the issue of exercising voice in a museum, and one of the areas I look to is development studies, because international development studies is long further ahead, and the literature in development studies is really useful in this area, examining critically participation and collaboration and what are the dynamics and politics of these relationships. And Andrea Cornwall is one of these people. She's based at the University of Sussex. It basically, it requires more than simply seeking to allow everyone to speak and asserting the need to listen. It requires a much more subtle consciousness of the dynamics of how these relationships work. So this has been a huge part of my work, has been trying to look at how this happens. Something I wrote called A Cake Report, Whose Cake Is It Anyway, is really came down to how these relationships play out in reality. And that without stopping and reflecting collectively, we never get to find out what's really going on within these situations. So here we have that staff room. This isn't the staff room, but it was very typical of a staff room, staff lunchroom. So when I conducted the Whose Cake Is It Anyway study, which is available online, it is I wanted to find out what was going on, because what was happening in the at the Manchester Museum and other places where I was asked to go was that there were relationships breaking down. And I know, I can remember Hackney. I remember during the bicentenary of the abolition of the Slave Trade Act, when many museums were involved. And I remember you, Sue, talking about breakdown in relationships where, you know, there are lots of misunderstandings and lots of difficulties and lots of clashes. And the museum is not very good at handling conflict. Museums aren't good at handling a conflict. So what came out when I was asked to look at 12 institutions across the UK by the Paul Hanlon Foundation, this was the end result, basically. Empowerment light, false consensus, where there's an assumption of consensus, where the institution is saying, well, we're all in agreement now, when actually we haven't voiced or aired the disagreement or any potential disagreement, because the institution is moving along and is often on a conveyor belt of production in terms of its events, its programs, its exhibitions, that make it very difficult to stop and say, are we really agreeing here? And then, you know, the old false promises, you know, that we're going to work together, we're going to collaborate, and actually the collaboration doesn't hold true. And this is, I won't stop at the many examples I have. I have too many stories in my head. But it came down to, for me, very clearly, the museum looking at its collaboration with others, whether they be migrants or other groups, as beneficiaries or active agents, and the difference it makes when we shift our notion of kindness, of helping, of treating the other as a victim, to looking at how that person is an active agent or could be in their own right, and looking at Amartya Sen's notion of what do we do to support their active agency and their capability development. So how do they shift? These are young migrants at the British Museum working at another program. So the other element of this, so this is the cake report, the Whose Cake Is It Anyway, the unwillingness of the museum to relinquish the position, a position, towards a genuine dialogue, also showed what is at the other, at the heart of the other side of this. And there's a level of fear, a fear of loss of control, as though there is a realization that behind the generous casting of relations between the two parties, there's always the danger of antagonism. And despite an avowed and genuine commitment to shared authority, the museum guards the position throughout its relationship too often with others, and often in the case of migrants. As the political theorist Chantal Mouffe puts it, we are, and I think it's a useful concept, friendly enemies. It's better to think of us as friendly enemies rather than, because we're not inhabiting a level playing field. And so this is what came up. Linda Tuhawai-Smith, the well-known researcher in Maori and Indigenous education, notes that in partnerships with museums, negotiations are also about respect for the opposition. So people may not be, we have to look at others, that they may have and may need to have the opportunity to critique us, to challenge us, to use us as an exercise in challenging authority. And that we have to be open and engage with that. And also, as Tuhawai-Smith reminds us, some knowledges are actively in competition with each other. And that for people, for example, migrants, giving an oral account, which they're almost always asked or required to do, means their stories may be have a powerful imperative as a form of resistance. It may actually be a form of resistance. It may not be what the museum's taking it, acquiring it for, but for the person contributing it, it may be a form of resistance. So how do we avoid this empowerment light and the false promises? Another example here is I was up in Scotland, and there was a celebration of museums' work with migrants. And the migrants, there were a lot of funding agencies collected around, and the migrants each were asked to thank the institutions for their participation, for their experience, which put them in a very peculiar position. And I noted it was uncomfortable that they were each asked to present their gratitude. I was interested in, there was a young man who was filming and photographing for the museums, and he himself was a migrant. And he said, I got speaking to him. He was Iranian, and he ran in Iran a political blog for young people, international. Of course, that meant now nobody is asking his opinions, because as he and others said to me, we cannot speak about politics. But he said, the situation that we're in makes us feel like grateful children. So how do we avoid the infantilization of the migrant who comes within this situation, who is powerless, relatively powerless? So is our job to assist them to regain some power or maintain them in a powerless situation? And so, you know, I had another experience with very close to here, actually, but in London. And it was where an institution was working with migrant women in the East End of London. And the idea was that the women's voices should be represented or expressed, and that was a good start. However, the way, and this was very recent, and the way this played out was that the women were never invited into the institution. The institution met with them off-site. So they were mainly Muslim women, and the institution came and set up, it was an arts practice, the women were gathered around a table and placed in the position of learners, passive learners. So the lead was taken by the institution. It did not involve asking the women what they had to bring. I mean, it seems sometimes, I mean, I know for people like you who are working at the Migrant Museum, sometimes this is fairly surprising, maybe, that there's still practice like this, but there is a lot of practice like this. So I wanted to just include this because there was an incident one day I walked in, and they had asked me to look at this program. And I walked in, and the women, I came early, and the women were gathered around a laptop. And they were really excited and engaged. And the institution, the cultural institution, hadn't arrived yet, the people from that. And I was asking what's going on, and they had been interviewed. This is they had been interviewed by the BBC that morning about the radicalization of young Muslims. And they were being asked as mothers their opinion on radicalization. And in a quite offensive way, of course, but they were being asked, like, how are you responsible, basically, for this? But the women had so many opinions after the BBC interview. So they were absolutely buzzing with this. When the session began, we trooped into the room, and that was ended. So there were no, their opinions were no longer relevant, because the relationship was that they were now learners. They were passive learners. So this is what I'm interested in. And of course, I interviewed these women extensively, and they had skills, they had experiences, of course, that were not part of the exchange. And as somebody said this at the end, we'll come and teach you things, but more about their existing skills. Is it a real exchange? So even though we have in this case the Institute saying it's about an exchange, the exchange isn't real in the actual, in how it actually plays out. So what does that look like? If Fasson, Didier Fasson, if you're interested in the philosophy around all of this and the critique of our humanitarianization of the world, I highly recommend look at Didier Fasson's work. And he talks about it as the growth of a secular religion of redemption and symbolic reparation that we are engaged in. It's like another religious or Christian impulse to save. And Arundhati Roy is extremely good on this, the writer and activist. Here she says, you know, if you look at what's happening here, it's diffusing political anger, there's political anger that exists around the whole migrant issue, of course, and on all sides. So we dole out benevolence or aid, but we move aside, and I've done it in my own practice. We avoid the confronting the difficult stuff around these issues. So who are we doing a favor for? And are we positioning ourselves as the arbiters, the interpreters, the facilitators, which makes us step out of it as though we're not engaged? I've had people say to me, I'm angry and I want you to answer back. I don't want you to go, I hear your pain. I'm really, you know, and I'm sympathetic with you. You know, are you a human in this conversation? You know. We're, again, this notion that we're moving away really far from this passive. What I find, actually, is that a lot of the practice that we had moved beyond with other populations had moved backwards with migrant populations. And I find that really quite disturbing. So it's back to this notion of victimization, and what does that do when we place people in that position? So it is, there is an invisible hand of prejudice in the museum. That is this notion of giving. You know, I read a whole document about the importance of practicing kindness in arts and cultural institutions. No, that's not what this is about. This doesn't mean that we're against being kind in the world, but it's understanding what does that mean when we're practicing generosity or kindness. You're putting somebody on the receiving end of that in a position that they cannot get beyond. So yeah, there's somebody, Maori, who talks about it, calls it soft bigotry, that we're practicing. I quite like the term. I think it's quite a useful term, soft bigotry. Yeah, this is Pearson, the you know, it bypasses this whole notion that, you know, they too want what we want, you know, that people who come want what we want. So it's moving away from the museum as moving towards the museum as partners, not saviors. We're not saviors in this relationship. And I would like to go back to what I found was a central issue of museums presenting victimization and painful situations. And what museums have become more and more adept at doing is presenting humanitarian crises in exhibitions. And the question is, where does that leave the passive consumption of these messages? What does this do in terms of where we go? This is Sarkozy visiting Rwandan genocide. In my own experience, I've written about it in a paper called Legacies of Prejudice. We had an exhibition on racism, and we co-produced it in the museum back in Manchester some years back. And the notion was that we would co-produce an exhibition on a very difficult subject that included the museum's own history of racist practice, scientific racism. And so it was all about the museum revealing its own history. However, we collaborated, and we produced the exhibition, but the relationship with our collaborators broke down. This is what has become so fascinating. And why it broke down, and I write about this a great deal, is because while we were happy to talk about racism in the past, we were less happy to talk about racism in the present, and the racism, the institutional racism, that played out within the museum institution itself. So the anger from our collaborators came up through that. And so what became very interesting was, how do we move beyond that? So our collaborators were telling us, well, the museum is racist. In fact, all museums are racist. So we held a public debate on called Are Museums Racist? It was absolutely packed out in Manchester. We had a huge turnout. And the public debate showed such a great deal of anger. What became interesting, it would have been better to do the exhibition the other way around and have had this consultation. Because in fact, the passion and partisanship, as Mouffe talks about, it was all there. We as a museum had unwittingly put a damper on it. We bypassed it. We looked at the minutes of our meetings. We adeptly bypassed it whenever conflict arose. And so we had this public debate, and what became interesting to me, and actually quite a fixation for me afterwards, was that conflict is at the heart of this. That in fact, if we are practicing a democratic practice that says we want to work equitably, we cannot avoid conflict. In fact, we don't look for conflict, but we cannot avoid it. And you know, when I look at this, is the Museum of Migration in Paris, the Immigration Museum in Paris. I mean, what I find when I walk through an institution, and I've written about this again, is that it bypasses all the conflict. It tells the history, but not any. It doesn't show what were the conflicts surrounding this. What was it like to be in the position of being a migrant through these histories? While I'm there, there are migrant families walking around everywhere. What's it like for them now? Because it's not in this museum. What I found curious is that Franz Fanon's books are in the museum shop. And the issue here is we are using museums here presumably to bring about some kind of change. If we're signed up to any kind of social justice, then change is part of that, part and parcel. So therefore, our ability to host this kind of critical questioning become central to what we do at museums. It has to be. You know, and so, you know, coming out from behind the positionings that we hold, and we all hold them, and there are ways of doing this, and we have to do them. It's set part and parcel to reflective practice so that we can be open to these kinds of discussions. And I love this notion, the Palestinian Museum's notion of a safe place for unsafe ideas. I mean, it almost should be on the banner for every institution, every museum institution. Because, you know, we, all of us who have worked with migrants in museums will have heard again and again that the museum is a safe place. And that's wonderful. But is it safe for everyone's views? Is it safe for the migrant to speak out about their views? And for migrants to differ with each other in terms of their views and with the institutions? So how aware are we? You know, as sites of solidarity and struggle, this notion that it's ongoing struggle, it's Carl Schmitt's notion and Chantal Mouffe's notion, that struggle is ongoing and it always will be. For God's sake, we're trying to get humans to live and work with each other. It'll always be a struggle. So the question that is this notion of humanitarianization, and is humanitarianism a way of making the intolerable somewhat bearable? But for the institution, what is it doing for those who are actually coming to work with us? Who actually benefits from the approach? And this notion of a radical collaboration. Nina Simon talks about this. We need to move towards a more radical collaboration that allows air into it, allows passion into it, that allows people to have actual voice. So this notion of a rights-based practice is growing, and how are rights exercised within the museum, and what are migrants' rights within the museum to develop their own capabilities, to exercise their voice, to protest, to make change happen? How are we facilitating that? You know, as Davies says, their anger and dissatisfaction and sense of injustice needs hearing, not treating. They're not victims that need treating. They need to be heard. So so I'm just going to mention a couple of other projects. Multaka, who knows about Multaka project? Hands up anybody who does, yeah. The Multaka project is in Berlin. It's got a huge amount of coverage. It's begun at the Museum of Islamic Art, one of the major museums on Museum Island in National Museum in Berlin. They asked me to come and look at how it's working. I've done quite a bit of work with the museum staff, who are mostly academic staff, very traditional research staff, and the Multaka group, who began as a separate organization to the museum and now have been taken into the museums as museum staff, which is an interesting switch. But the issue here is that the notion was to recruit refugees as guides, four other refugees, to kind of claim the space and to interpret the collections in the museum in their own way. But also to open up a dialogue between refugees and other Berliners to break open that dialogue. So what's been interesting is how free are they to talk? So it's an ongoing process. And what's very useful about it and very good is that they're doing it very consciously. And the collaborators, the refugees who are now paid, are questioning all the time as they develop this. So now they're working with the other museums, the historical museum and some of the other Byzantine museum, to look at, to interpret those. I thought what was interesting is originally they were trained by museum educators to deliver their tours in a museum educator fashion. So in that in itself put some boundaries. It was kind of saying, well, this is how you need to engage. That has developed. So it's worth watching this project to see how much these are beneficiaries or active agents, how much they're challenging the institution. The institution says it wants to become the Museum of Islamic Art wants to learn from Multaca to change its entire way of working. So far that hasn't happened. It's a very traditional museum. It's like the British Museum. But they, with astounding collections, you know, that have come from a whole history of colonialism. But there is potential here. But it's quite an interesting model to look at how that could be replicated in institutions elsewhere, especially institutions with large colonial collections. This is your Migration Museum. Wonderful museum. This was, of course, an incredibly powerful exhibition, Call Me By My Name. And the reason that I mention it and have written about it elsewhere is because of the collaboration with migrants in Calais who actually helped with the collecting of objects to put the exhibition together and contributed their stories and a whole lot of other elements to the exhibition. Is that right? So the question is, you know, I guess the question
within the limitations of what they were able to do, because some of them were still in the camp, and some of them were here applying for asylum, so couldn't reveal themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
So it wasn't as simple as you described it.
No, it was tricky. I've no doubt it was tricky, but would you say that the intention of this was to, so this whole notion that I'm putting forward to active agency versus beneficiary, all of that, where would you say it stood on that spectrum? Was the intention to create opportunities for active agency?
I think the intention, first of all, was what you were saying, is to give them a voice, so that their voices could be heard within those limitations that I'm describing. Their voices could be heard first, and secondly, their voices could be heard in the way that they wanted them to be heard. Not the way the press were shouting about them, not the way the politicians were shouting about them, but when we went into the camp, the question that we asked was, what would you like people in the UK to know about you? So we empowered them to tell their story in the way that they wanted it.
Yeah. And some interesting things came out of that, because I remember there was some oral histories we collected at the time. It was just this idea of conflict, actually, and they were very angry at the aid workers. And they said, you know, we don't want biscuits in your clothes that you keep giving us. We want asylum, you know, we want a solution to this problem. And that was really interesting, because those were some of the perspectives we were then able to kind of present.
Yeah.
Which did have a lot of, you know, it wasn't just being sort of grateful for what everyone is doing for us.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, we are not just, you're talking about migrants. No, but migrants are human beings.
Of course.
They have families, they have professions.
Of course.
They have, you know, they have loves, they have hates.
Of course.
They're not
of course.
Migrants. I think we wanted to get that across as well.
That these are individuals and they're human beings.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And this is central to this whole notion of you being your capability, your individuality, your active agency is all about people stepping outside of that step. Yeah, of course, absolutely. What has been interesting for me is looking at how do these play out? Are they moving on that trajectory towards more active agency? Or not? And it's quite an interesting question to ask when I'm looking at what museums, because museums now are working with migrant populations everywhere, absolutely everywhere, all over Europe, everywhere. And so it's, and they really vary how they're working. Sometimes it comes back to the old worst practice of you tick the box, you know, we've done. And what you get now, and I noticed this in in Berlin, some resentment between migrant groups because some groups are getting more coverage than other groups and all kinds of issues. The Syrians are much more than other groups, you know, Afghanis not so much, maybe, and then others down the line. And are we feeding into this? You know, these are questions we have to ask about our practice, you know. And so this is Battersea. You've no doubt done the work they're doing here. And the stories, I haven't seen it in practice, have you?
Yes.
So can you, maybe you could tell about how this works.
We went round the Battersea Arts Centre and we went, we heard people telling their stories. We were in a group of sort of five and we wandered around and we went into a room and we sat down and that person told their story. And it could be something that had happened to them 10, 20 years ago, or they could be right in the middle of their story now. And we then moved off and listened to somebody else's story. And then another group came and listened. And that person probably told their story 8 times a night or something for a period of, was it a month? It went over?
A couple of weeks.
A couple of weeks. So they were repeating and repeating and repeating that suddenly very traumatic story. And there was no, what I found very hard was when you had to get up and go, and you couldn't empathize, you couldn't talk to that person.
Yeah.
So it was left hanging a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But you were able, at the end of the, at the end of the session, at the end of listening to the stories, they had a kind of room where there were objects related. Each person was able to put an object which told their story. The most important thing, I think, the most good thing that came out of that, she was able to write a letter to that person whose story had so most affected you.
Yeah.
And you could say, I listened to your story and I empathised with you, I felt it, or whatever you wanted to say. So, and we heard afterwards, didn't we, at the, conference, the event that we organised. That was the best thing for those people, that with that communication with their audience. That they felt that their voices had been heard, and those people that we had,
and that you had responded,
yes.
Yeah.
The, what was very interesting about the kind of the case study when they fed back was that they, you know, a few people did say doing it, repeating their story 5 times a night, 7 nights a week for a month, was ended up taking a kind of huge emotional toll on them, and that was something that I think as that the Bassi Arts Centre was going to kind of think about moving forward and how they would approach more delicately.
Yeah.
I remember one of the storytellers, this comment stayed with me, she said, I felt really angry at my audience because I would tell my story and then they would just leave and they left with my story and I went in.
It seems so rude, apart from anything else.
I mean, everyone had really diverse experience and then other people said they really love the experience of sharing their story. So I think that just goes to show there's no consensus on it either.
It's interesting, but how many of you have worked with migrants in a museum situation? 3 of you? This is the this is one of my favorite museums, Kreuzberg Museum. Do you know it in Berlin? It's they're just so embedded in their community and have been, and it's a campaigning museum. They make no bones about it. They're absolutely embedded in their local area. And always have been. And it is this notion, I mean, there are museums now, I'm working with one a lot in Denmark, that openly calls itself a campaigning museum, the welfare museum in Denmark. And this is, and the museum had all kinds of trouble politically around this exhibition. And maybe you guys are familiar with it. It was quite a back and forth. They tried to shut it down. The government, the city tried to shut it down. So the museum really went to bat for the to work with the refugees. And the refugees very much took charge of their own. It was a protest. It was activating a protest. So you know, this is the notion of how much social responsibility museums are taking. And how active? Are we campaigning? Are we political? We're most definitely not neutral, and certainly on this issue. of to do with migration. How can anybody take a neutral position on this? So what is our role? What is our role? And when you look at the different practices, where do we stand in relation to it? And this is another one at EMEC in Berlin. Sorry, there's so much in Berlin because Berlin, of course, it's such a huge... and I just put, you know, what they worked with a whole number. They drew on the walls. They drew their memories. It was home. It was about home. And Daheim. Did anybody speak German? And it's and I mean it's you know, I'm not saying that it isn't important that we deal with emotion. We absolutely have. How can you not? But sometimes that emotion is anger, and sometimes it's sorrow, and sometimes it's loss. But it isn't our job to put a lid on it. And how much? I mean, in this case, it's the walls. You have the walls, you know. And so what does it look like? And when people are workshopping the ideas themselves, you know, and developing, what does that look like? How much do we relinquish, and can we relinquish, if our intention is this notion of developing capability, that they walk out of there feeling much stronger? And it's not about us. They may never walk inside the door again. But they may feel some strength and capability of dealing with authority and telling their own stories elsewhere. So, pity porn, if we put these kind of images up in the institution, there are so many of them, our social justice and solidarity. You know, how much are we talking about people taking charge of their own stories and protesting? You know, and just as you said, Sue, we are human. My favorite quote in the world, Eduardo Galeano, again, I'd like it to be on the wall of museums. Charity is vertical. It's humiliating. And so solidarity is the notion that is a very old and very useful notion. And it is also the kind of humility to say, I have an awful lot to learn from people that I'm working with. I'm not doing for, I'm working with you, and I have loads to learn. I have a colleague who's just come back from Athens working in City Plaza. You know, people know about City Plaza.
The hotel.
The hotel.
Yes, yeah. I've been there, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, and you know, the interesting thing is how they organize, and the meetings are interesting. They're really interesting, and I think have lessons outside of that kind of situation. They're not just a refuge; it's a way. Because the big issue is that people are using their skills there, and that's and they're meeting and they're making decisions and they're planning and they're growing outside of being victims. So, this is City Plaza. I have some pictures of that. And, I mean, it's just simple things, like the fact that people are organizing and meeting and discussing and, you know, and having... Do you know some of these people?
Yeah, I've been in that very cafe.
Oh, great, good. And it's, you know, and they're very much campaigning. They're demonstrating all the time in solidarity with others. And they also have a whole lot of fun. It's... very celebratory, and the big difference is that it's mixed completely, people from all over, and that doesn't happen very often. And of course, museums can be also responsible. Sorry, I sound like it's my knock museums day, but it's museums are also do the segregation, don't they? We'll work with this group, now we'll work with that group, now we'll work with that group. How are we working together? How are we setting up situations where we break out of those boxes and those ghettos? And this is it's just a lovely model, you know? And I think it's a very nice model, kind of politically, of how they're organizing it. And, I mean, their meetings go on for some time. And you're going to... And it's decision making is a whole other way of doing it.
And they have a fantastic LGBT group as well there, which is incredible.
Incredible.
You know, among with refugees who coming from countries where they can never come out as LGBT.
Yeah.
And the Athenians are
and
they're
really
amazing things in that
supportive.
Very place.
I know. But I mean, you know, I've been thinking about this. Why isn't this a model for some of our own practice? Why aren't we looking at how they're organizing, how they're meeting, how decisions are being made, you know, how they celebrate, how they, you know, how they work together? Because this is all about capability building. Absolutely. Every bit of it. So I find that. There are, do you know this organization, Migrants Organize? So, I don't know it, but I think it's the whole notion of acting for justice, and this is the active word here. So how do we build on that within the museum, you know? Hang on, let me just see. So, I mean, I think my own work has always been about the imperative to make these kinds of subtle prejudices visible in our own, in ourselves, and in the way that we work. And it is, to me, that is an absolute imperative. And we all have them, and we've all had them. And it's the reason that we have to keep going back again and again and reflecting with others on how we're approaching our work with others. So it's, you know, so that we're not inadvertently practicing soft bigotry, and that is absolutely the opposite of any of what any of us want to do. So I think that's it. Thank you.